Imagine that right now you are in Kenya, watching elephants majestically wander the plains in front of towering Mount Kilimanjaro. Well, today on Radio Gorgeous, I'm thrilled to meet someone who is living that life, a true legend of the conservation world, Dr. Cynthia Moss. Many of you all know Cynthia from the award-winning films about the world-famous elephant Echo, which Cynthia presented alongside David Attenborough. In just a few days, Cynthia will be celebrating her 80th birthday. So let's find out more about her life and what has inspired her to spend over 50 years in the African bush. Hi, Cynthia. Welcome to Radio Gorgeous.
Hi, Corinna.
It's so great to have you here on the show. Now, I wanted to ask you, Cynthia, I know you grew up in New York. Can you tell us a little bit about your life before you first visited Kenya in 1967?
Okay, well, I grew up in the suburbs, just 30 miles outside of New York City. So New York was really where we did anything in terms of culture or in music or plays and et cetera. So I had that at my, you know, just nearby. But I fell in love with horses at the age of 7. So that was my big thing. And I ended up, luckily, had my own horse when I was 12 and used to ride in beautiful places in Westchester County on these gorgeous trails and in these woods. And slowly I began to see them disappear. And so I became very interested in the protection of the environment and saving wilderness from a very early age when nobody else seemed to be that interested in it. One of the reasons to come to Africa was I wanted to see one of the last wilderness areas. So that was what spurred me to visit in the first place. And I just wanted to see that kind of wildness. And the animals were actually sort of the icing on the cake for me. I was always interested in animals and had pets and everything, but I didn't know I would have a passion for studying them at that point. A good friend of mine from college had gone to Africa and wrote the most beautiful letters about Africa, about the landscapes. And she was a painter. She is a painter. She really convinced me that that was where I wanted to go. So I took a leave of absence from Newsweek. I was working for Newsweek magazine in New York after university. I took 2 months in Africa and the rest of the time in the Middle East and Europe just to travel around.
Wow.
And of course, I fell in love with Africa within a week of getting here, as so many people do. You know that.
Yes, I do. And, beautiful.
Yeah, it's just, if it grabs you, you're ruined forever or not. I was lucky enough to meet somebody who was doing a study of elephants in Tanzania. And I was invited, because I was there for 2 months, so I was invited down for 3 weeks to be a volunteer. And that really grabbed me completely. Then I got hooked on elephants.
Wow.
But it could have been anything. It might have been zebras or something. a lot of my life has been serendipity in those early stages of how I got to where I am now. It's just bits of luck and bits of serendipity.
But that means, so I think, doesn't it? It's meant to be when that happens, isn't it? Everything kind of falls into place.
Yes, yes. When my leave was up, I went back to New York. I was invited to be a permanent researcher, and I couldn't resist. And I had to give up everything, my job, my apartment, my 2 cats, my horse. But I've never regretted it for a moment.
I know you've been researching elephants for over 50 years. In that time, what do you think you have learned about elephants?
Oh, they're really nice animals.
Yes.
You know, the way that they cooperate with each other is so impressive, you know, within the families. They're good to each other. They're loyal to each other. They care about each other. Mm. They have a lot of the qualities that we wish all humans had. They have a very supportive society that's matriarchal, of course. I find that fascinating. I find the whole concept of leadership and cooperation instead of competition fascinating with elephants.
I mean, you mentioned it there about the matriarch society. I mean, everyone at Radio Gorgeous is high-fiving about that, about the groups being led by a female. I know you've researched that role a lot. What have you learned about that role, Cynthia?
Well, it's very interesting that elephants can live into their 70s, so they live a very long time. Wisdom is very important in the elephant world, in elephant life. So the oldest, it's always the oldest female, with a few exceptions, who leads the family. And the others are looking to that female for her knowledge, her wisdom, her experience. And when that female dies, it's not her daughter who takes over, which in the primate world, say the chimp world, it's a daughter who always takes over as the alpha. But in elephants, it's the next oldest, who could be a sister or a cousin, but they start looking toward her because she's the one who's had the most experience, and they orient to her and follow what she decides to do.
Thinking about matriarchs, I think probably the most famous matriarch that's ever lived is Echo. Oh, gorgeous Echo. I mean, I was really lucky to see Echo on two separate visits to Kenya, I have to say, in 2005 and 2009, the year she passed away. And I'll never forget her walking past me and turning around and looking, and this look she had in her eyes, just such a special, you know, you could see right into her soul, such a special character. And I mentioned earlier that you fronted lots of films about Echo along with David Attenborough. And I think these films have touched so many people, Cynthia, and I think they've really changed people's perception of elephants, haven't they? And of them, you know, being sentient beings. And I wondered if you could talk a little bit about how you got involved with that, how you got involved with the BBC, how you got involved with the whole concept of Echo and the films.
Well, I had many film companies approaching me to do a film, you know, once they knew about the study. This is when I was about 10 or 15 years into the study, and people wanted to come and do films. They still do. but anyway, I had resisted all along. And one particular producer, a wonderful woman named Marion Zuntz, who was very innovative in her way of looking at wildlife films, she approached me several times, and she was a good friend of a friend. Toward the end of the 1980s, when we realized how bad the poaching was and the ivory trade, Kenya's elephants went from like 150,000 down to 16,000. It was just devastating. And I thought, well, all right, I have to stop, or not stop, but at least pull back on the research and do something to raise people's awareness about elephants. So I got in touch with Marion, and I said, all right, Marion, I give in. So she came out, this was in 1989, to discuss it all. And then we started in January 1990, and she brought a cameraman who turned out to be the perfect person, Martin Kolbeck, who was an excellent cameraman. She had the idea of following one family, and nobody else had actually done this. It's interesting how wildlife films back then were usually on the seasons or on this or that, and she wanted to follow one family over time. And she said, well, can you choose a family? I got it down to three families, and I decided that it needed to be a family that was fairly easy to find, needed to be quite habituated to vehicles, and it needed to have a female. The matriarch needed to be distinctive looking, so the audience also would recognize her, you know. Ah. So it came down to Echo, because she was very distinctive looking, and they were homebodies. They didn't go very far in those days. It was a very good choice. So Martin and I started in January, and then we went out every day and followed them. And then at a certain point, we said, gosh, you know, nothing's really happening. How can we make a film out of this? So, you know, and we got panicky, you know, that nothing was going to happen. Then one morning, we went out and we found the family. And we found Echo with a brand new calf. Oh. But that was Eli, who was crippled.
That's right.
Of course, that was such a drama. And then we were off and running.
You came back to tell her story in several other films, didn't you, over the years?
Yes, I think we did four films with the BBC. And then we did a 10-part series with Animal Planet. Yeah, we did a lot of films.
What did Echo mean to you, Cynthia?
Oh,
she was basically, she became my matriarch. My job was to get Martin in the right place at the right time to film the behaviors and film something I thought was about to happen. And very subtly, I noticed over the first months that I was watching Echo all the time, aware of what Echo was doing and all the little intention movements that she had. And so she became my matriarch. And she taught me so much about elephants and about family life with elephants, just being with that family. I had not done that. And it really opens up your eyes if you spend time with just one family. Otherwise, we go out and do censuses and then go to the next group and record this and that. But this was staying with a female for several years, and with a female and her group and getting to know every one of them so well. It was just such a pleasure. It was a joy.
I mean, that's an interesting concept, isn't it? That actually by making the films, that helped your scientific research.
It did. Yes, definitely. Following a family for whatever, however many years, 40 something years, is that you have all that history in the back of your head. The things you've seen them do, the births and the deaths, and the matriarch was.
How do you record all of that information? How do you capture everything you're learning about the dynamics of individual elephants and their families?
Well, we have a massive database, a huge database of all the sightings, all the births and deaths, all the must behavior, all the estrus behavior.
You mentioned there about must bulls. Can you explain what that is? Because that's a quite unique concept, isn't it?
Yeah, there aren't many other species who have anything like it. My colleague, Joyce Poole, who did the major work on must, and this is a time when his testosterone levels and other hormone levels surge. They're really, really high. And he changes. It's almost like a Jekyll and Hyde transformation where he goes from a nice, placid young male to this raging bull, so to speak. When he comes into must, he lifts his head and he struts and he waves his ears in a particular way, and he's streaming from the glands on the side of his face. He's dribbling urine with other substances. He has all these different postures and gestures. And a special must rumble he uses. He then goes searching for females. But the females will make a special greeting to a must male, which they don't to other males. They do the special hello, fella,
a bit of flirting, Cynthia.
And there's some of the males seem to like even more than others. So there was one during the filming of the first two Echo films, the Dionysus, who was beloved by everybody, by all the families. They would always greet him with this female chorus, and males would sort of put their trunks up, and they obviously were in awe of him. He was a wonderful bull.
Because now I know in Amboseli you're having a baby boom, aren't you, with it raining twins, which is very unusual.
It certainly is. We have two sets born this year. I just saw one set yesterday. They're doing very well.
Oh, good.
Very cute.
Oh, they are. They look absolutely adorable. And I know so many people around the world are rooting for them. Because it's difficult, isn't it, for a female to feed two young ones at the same time?
Absolutely. Absolutely. They have to produce all that milk. The first set we ever had was 1980. And those grew up to well beyond adult, their adulthood. And that was Estella, and she had Eclipse and Equinox.
Oh, I love those names.
And Equinox is still alive. Sadly, Eclipse died in 2017. We think she may have died during a complicated birth. The second set was in 2018, and one of them died. It was a male and female again, and one died when they were 6 months old. And then the third set was in February, and that was extremely interesting because one was born. BBC were actually filming this, and they didn't fill the earth, but they arrived when the calf was a few, you know, just a couple hours old. I think that was the male. And then 4 days later, they came, and there was another calf.
No.
And everyone thinks that the second calf belonged to somebody else. But we all searched to find if there was a female that looked like she'd lost her calf, whether it was a dead female, and nothing. It was that mother. She'd had a calf 4 days later. And then the fourth set was with the family that spends a lot of time outside the park. So when they came in just this month, they were already 3.5 months old. Their mother is not a great big female, Pazia, but she seems to be doing really well with her calf.
So oh, good. Nice. I'm pleased. I mean, it's interesting hearing you talk about Amboseli. What do you think makes it such a haven for wildlife? Because I know you've got so many different species of beautiful animals there.
Well, it's a tiny park by African park standards, but it's very rich because it has these permanent swamps that are fed from underground rivers from Kilimanjaro. So it's a real haven for wildlife, especially in the dry season. But right now it's just packed with animals, lots of wildebeest and zebras and all the gazelles and lions and cheetahs and giraffes.
There's about 1,700 elephants in the population, but they're never all here at the same time. They spread out over the ecosystem. Amboseli is only 392 square kilometers, which is about 150 square miles.
Right.
But the ecosystem is much, you know, 10 times as big.
Yeah.
And they're able to move far away. And in fact, the EBs were gone for 5 months. They only came back about 3 or 4 days ago. Very disturbed. In fact, I told my assistants, I told Nora and Katija, you know, if they don't come back by my birthday, I'm never going to speak to them again.
Well, they obviously heard you, Cynthia.
I was very upset. Because I don't feel like it's right unless I've seen them, you know, having had such a long history with them. So they left in February, and we have no idea where they were. We think they were in Tanzania. And they just suddenly marched back in as if nothing had ever happened. And now the last two nights they've been in camp. I mean, literally under my veranda this morning at 3 o'clock.
No.
This family feels that this camp is theirs and they can come and eat the things that nobody else has the nerve to do. 2 days after they came back, two of the females gave birth. Wow. And I just missed them. I was out and I saw that everybody was bunched and I heads up and all excited and discovered that there were two new calves that were less than, you know, like an hour old, if anything.
And in addition to following the elephants and recording all of their movements and all the science, I know there's been so much scientific research that you and the team have carried out on the elephants. I know you also did a lot of other projects as well, such as community involvement and education scholarships. Could you talk to us a little bit about that?
Well, I guess really the first true community project I initiated was something I call the Consolation Program, which is paying owners of livestock, sheep, cows, sheep, and goats, for if an elephant kills them. Elephants will sometimes just will kill a cow or something if they just come upon them in thick bush or whatever, and they don't go out of their way, but they do sometimes. And before, every time a cow was killed, then the Maasai Maran, the warriors, felt that they had to retaliate and kill an elephant. So that was just nowhere because it didn't help anything.
No.
And I initiated, took a long time to get approval and everything. So we pay the owner directly to the owner, not through any middleman.
Right.
Money for the whatever, the livestock. And that I initiated that in 1996, and it's been fabulous. It really has helped tremendously, and it's been a very good program. And then in early, I guess it was, I don't know when I started, I guess early 1990s, I also started sending kids to university from the Maasai community around Amboseli. Failed to talk about why Amboseli was so special for wildlife, it's because they live with Maasai, who don't go out of their way to kill animals, so don't eat any wildlife. So they're really responsible for keeping this, for making this a wonderful conservation area. I wanted to help them in any way I could. And so I realized how hard it was for people to get enough money to send their kids to university. So I started that program. And then I decided that the girls were not getting the education that they deserved. And so I started a program of sending girls to secondary school from the community. And that's been very, very good and rewarding to see them going through. And two of the girls we started in secondary, finished secondary, we sent them to through university, and now they're in graduate school.
Oh, Cynthia, that's just amazing. Really, honestly, you must be very proud.
I am.
And then we also pay scouts. We employ 15 Maasai scouts who give us information about elephants outside the park. So we have quite a few different things that we do. But the education part is very rewarding, and I enjoy that.
Oh, I bet. I can totally understand that. Talking about elephants, I guess one of the elephants in the room, so to speak, is, and you mentioned it earlier, is ivory poaching. Now, I know that elephants are facing lots of other different threats. Could you talk us through some of those and what's happening to try and combat that?
Well, sadly, there still is ivory poaching. We thought it would go way down when China stopped its ivory sales, but now it's sort of gone to Vietnam and Laos, and the Chinese just travel over there and buy ivory and take it back. So it's very discouraging, actually. It's very hard to sort of seem to break that pattern that they have of buying ivory for different reasons. So there still is poaching. We have a wonderful organization here called the Big Life Foundation. They have 350 rangers all in the ecosystem. Fabulous anti-poaching job. So we haven't had any. Like all of last year, we didn't have a single elephant poached. For Kenya's done actually very well, having lost almost all its elephants at one point to poaching. It has done well. The population has grown again to a certain, not nowhere near what it was, but it has grown. It seems to be under control here, but our immediate problem here was loss of habitat, and it is throughout Africa.
And do you also worry about climate change, Cynthia? Because I know, again, you touched on earlier that a lot of the lushness of Amboseli comes from the underground rivers that come from Kilimanjaro, with it being snow-capped. Is that a worry for the future?
I'm not too worried. I think most of it comes from rainfall rather than ice melting. So I'm worried about climate change in general.
Yeah.
I mean, temperatures has risen here in Amboseli. Average temperatures risen. So goodness knows what's going to happen in the future. And, you know, it's really extremely worrying. And when you have leaders who don't care, it's even more worrying.
Yeah, unbelievably, really. You've been researching elephants, Cynthia, for around 50 years, but I know an elephant can live to 70. What is there still left to discover? What would you still like to learn?
Well, right now, the only gap we have, I'm sure we have many more, but the young males leave their families around 12 to 14 years old, and then they have this long period of 15, 16 years when they're wandering around. We don't know very much about what happens to them in that period, and we're trying to find out. Vicky Fishlock, one of my colleagues, has put 5 radio collars on 5 young males that recently left their families, or they're actually satellite collars. We'd like to know who they spend time with, where they go. So that's one of the gaps in our knowledge.
And in a few days, you're going to celebrate your 80th birthday, which is quite unbelievable. And you're still working, Cynthia. I mean, most people, you know, can't wait to retire at about 60, 65. What keeps you going?
Oh, the elephants, of course. I don't know what I would do. I would be bored. This is my life. This is what gives me happiness, and it's still fascinating to me everything about elephants still fascinates me, and I look forward. I was driving out yesterday, and I was out on the road starting my trip out, and then I thought, I'm just so happy, you know, just so happy to be here, to be able to still do this. And I don't know what I'm going to see today, but it's going to be interesting and never gets boring.
What a joy to do something you love.
Yes, yes, I do. I know how privileged I am. I definitely do.
Well, your work is funded through the charity that you set up, and I know that's funded by donors and small grants, and that you've got a very special appeal to honour your birthday. Can you tell us more about that? And if people want to help you, what can they do?
We're asking people to give multiples of 80, even 8, to honour the birthday. Then there's we self-published a book just recently. It's called Impressions of Amboseli, and it's with a wonderful artist named Sophie Walbioff. I don't know whether you and Anna came to the show. Did you and Anna
we
come
did,
to the show?
We did. And her, I have to say, her paintings are absolutely stunning. That was the last time I met you, Cynthia, at Sophie's show.
Yes. Yes. Well, she's just the most wonderful painter. She had done this gorgeous little book about Lamu, the island off the north coast of Kenya. She told me she loved to paint in Amboseli. And somehow we decided that maybe we should consider a book. My word. So we did it. And then in the end, we decided to just print it ourselves rather than try to get a publisher. It's not really on sale. So if people give a donation of $250 or more, they'll get a copy of the book.
And I know you've published a lot of other books in the past, Cynthia. So people will want to add this to their Cynthia Moss collection. That is for sure.
Yeah, no, I'm happy with it. I think it looks really nice. Yeah, I'm pleased with the way it turned out.
Well, Cynthia, thank you so much for coming onto Radio Gorgeous. Honestly, you are a true inspiration, and I wish you a really, really, really happy 80th birthday.
Thank you.
For more amazing interviews with amazing women, please visit radiogorgeous.com.